continue our board meeting, and we're going to talk about insurance. And I give the floor to Joanna.
Good afternoon. We have three papers today on the proposed amendments to IFRS 4. Two of those papers are for information only, and one paper, Agenda Paper 14C, is for decision making. We will start first with 14A and then proceed to 14B and so on and so forth. So I will turn it over to Connor, who will do 14A, and then later on we'll move on to Isa.
Thank you, Joanna. Good afternoon. So paper 14A is a summary of the feedback that the board and staff received on comment letters and outreach meetings. Following the publication of the exposure draft, proposed amendments to IFRS 4 for entities that apply IFRS 9 and IFRS 4. The board received comment letters from a range of constituents, including regulators, preparers of financial statements and their representative bodies, the accounting and actuarial professions, standard setters and users of financial statements. Paragraph 2 of the paper refers to 95 comment letters. We actually received another one on the day we completed this paper, so we actually received 96 letters. But fortunately, the 96th letter is consistent with the others, so their views are properly represented, I hope, in this paper. The paper 14A does not include the comment letters on users because they've been combined with the user outreach that Isa will be describing in paper 14B. So I propose to discuss the paper in sections, and I'll group some of the questions together to make the discussion more manageable. And I propose to have discussion after each section, otherwise we might forget when we get to the end. So I'll start with questions 1 and 2. Question 1 was about addressing the concerns it raised. And question 2 was a concern with proposing both an overlay approach and a temporary exemption. The responses to these questions are discussed in paragraphs 6 to 16 of the paper. In response to question 1, most comment letters agreed that the ISB should address the concerns that have been raised about basically insurers have to apply IFRS 4 and IFRS 9. And for question 2, most respondents were in favour of both overlay and temporary exemption being available to address the issues. Many preparers said that whilst they do not actually intend to use the overlay themselves, they could see that it'd be useful in some circumstances, and so they didn't object to it being available. I'd say that most preparers prefer the temporary exemption, and a few would prefer to use the overlay approach. Those are the points I wanted to highlight. Perhaps I'll take it to the board if you have any questions or comments on this section. No? Okay.
I have some observations, but should I hold them till we get to the question of voting on these issues?
We're only going to vote on 14C, so that's quite a way a while. So okay. It's up to you when you would like to raise them.
Just a couple of observations with respect to the items mentioned on page 4 through 5.
Okay.
I found these arguments very unconvincing from the standpoint of the issues discussed in paragraph 7. Here, if in fact an entity were to apply IFRS 9 and not be designating assets in the fair value to P&L category, meaning if they're using amortized cost or if they're using fair value OCI, in fact, expected credit loss information is highly relevant. Okay, so in that particular instance, it's not a wasted cost. In fact, it's providing a benefit, useful information. One of the reasons why we implemented this new approach or new model is that very purpose, to provide information about expected credit losses for assets designated in those two categories. So if they continue to use those two categories, okay, it would provide useful information. It wouldn't be wasted cost. Secondly, when they go to, if they go to, implementing a new insurance contract standard, they will undoubtedly have new designations. There's no question. But based on my experience and based on the written commentary that the industry has provided to us, they will have a very substantial amount of assets designated at amortized cost and fair value OCI. They have made this representation to us in comment letters leading up to the exposure draft and through the exposure draft period on classification and measurement issued in November of 12. Okay? So there's no question they're going to continue to have these categories. They will have a need for credit risk management systems, and this will not be a wasted cost. But while you're using IFRS 9, it clearly provide relevant information if you're not using the fair value through P&L category. With respect to this issue in 7C, a few were concerned about tax and regulatory impacts. At this table, as far as I know, I've never heard a board member express any empathy at all for the implications of tax consequences or regulatory consequences as a result of our decisions. In fact, I've heard just the opposite, a lack of empathy. So those arguments don't hold much weight in my book. I'll leave it there.
We'll be debating those arguments obviously in more detail when we come to 4C.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll just make one quick observation on the overlay approach. One thing that did trouble me, both in outreach but and also in the letters, is the comments made on the cost of the overlay approach. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I'm concerned about them is that I found the arguments hard to understand. Even in discussions with people, I felt it hard to understand exactly why things would be as costly as people thought or said they would be, mm-hmm. particularly when my understanding is a lot of the assets that they're talking about are available for sale assets today that they are concerned would move to fair value through profit or loss, so they already have the fair value information, it's already in reporting processes, and it's just a change of location. And I was somewhat concerned that perhaps what we're hearing here is feedback from people who don't want us to think that the overlay approach is a solution for them. So they want us to focus on the deferral as their solution and to sort of try and make sure that that might happen. There's been, I fear, a bit of overemphasis on the cost of the overlay approach. And I think we really struggled to find a population of people who really were going to use the overlay approach who gave us substantiated feedback, if I can use those words, on the cost of the overlay approach. And I thought it was very interesting that the handful of people that we did speak to who did want to apply the overlay approach actually said that the costs weren't particularly burdensome at all. And so I just worry a little bit about what's behind some of those comments.
I just make one other quick observation. Paragraph 6A. We wrote IFRS 9 and we designed the concept of business models around the way entities are managing their pools of financial assets and liabilities. It's supposed to give you an insight into actually how assets and liabilities are managed, unlike IAS 39 today, which is a free choice. You can pick this category, that category. You don't have to have a rationale. So in fact, if you adopt IFRS 9 before the insurance contract standard, you will in fact be afforded with more understandable information about how an entity manages their assets and liabilities, and in fact result in less confusion, not more confusion. Now, as to whether or not it introduces more volatility in reported P&L, I'm not going to debate that. That could in fact very well happen as a result of having to designate equities, for example, either owned directly or through funds in P&L. Or if you own structured securities that today you report through AFS, you may end up having those that fail the SPPI test in P&L. So there's no question, but that's economic volatility. That's not accounting volatility. And that's exactly what we said we wanted to highlight with IFRS 9. That's not accounting volatility. That's economic volatility.
Daryl?
So I think I agree with a lot of the comments that are being raised here, that I think in certain circumstances the cost argument has been overplayed. And I think I certainly, in the impressions I've had in meetings and drilling down and et cetera with people, I have got to the impression that it's a good argument to make, and there are certainly costs involved. I'm not sure the costs are as extensive as being portrayed in some of the letters we've got. So I agree with, I think, both Pat and Sue.
I'm may leave now. It might be
see, see the name tag?
I'm not sure I agree entirely with the point that, that Pat's making in terms of the assets and liabilities. I agree again that I think IFRS 9 is by far a better representation of the assets than the asset accounting. That said, I think much of the liability accounting under IFRS 4 has been put together in such a way that it reflects the way the assets are reflected under IAS 39. And IFRS 4 gave that latitude. It allowed you to report liabilities in a number of different ways. I have some sympathy with the arguments that are here that what this may require you to do is to reflect the changes that have happened in your assets as a consequence of applying the business model. You now have to change your IFRS 4 reporting in order to eliminate what could be in that circumstance just an accounting mismatch. And that would require essentially two changes in your liability accounting. One under IFRS 4 to reflect the fact that your assets have changed, and a further one when the new standard comes along. So I do think there is some merit in that second argument, but I would agree with where people are landing on the cost discussion.
Martin?
I also wanted to respond to what Pat has said, because I think the point is not what this people are making, saying IFRS 9 will not provide better information than IAS 39. That is not the point. People saying, okay, they have to really look at the liability side and the asset side, and we are changing the accounting for the liability side, and they want only to wait some years before they also then adequately change the asset side, because they saying it is for them simpler and easier and with less cost if they doing that once instead of doing now the asset side and later the liability side, and also some accounting noise can come from this changing the asset side prior to changing the liabilities. That is the point. It's not that they're making and saying, okay, IFRS 9 will not provide better information than IAS 39. It's a relation to our project, and therefore also the point is not that they argue that IFRS 9 is not a good thing. They say they want to only to wait some years before they implement an IFRS 9 in parallel when they're doing IFRS 4.
Philippe?
I have some comments, but maybe it's too early, about the below the reporting entity level discussion. Should I wait? Or
yes.
Yes.
Right now? Okay, it's about paragraph 34.
Wait.
Okay.
Carry on. So, question three, and that was about the mechanics of the overlay approach, and the responses are discussed in paragraphs 17 to 23. Points I wish to highlight are that regulators and some auditors felt that the ED proposals for identifying assets that qualify for the overlay adjustment are not sufficiently clear. They're concerned about potential inconsistency in application, and they've been requested more guidance and examples. And a few have asked for the requirements to be more restrictive. On the other hand, some standard setters, preparers and auditors think actually there's not much opportunity for tightening the definition further because of the range of circumstances in which a constrained description of qualifying assets would need to apply. The ED also asked for views on the proposals for presenting the effect of the overlay adjustment, and in response to this, some regulators and several other constituents felt that the flexibility for presenting the overlay adjustment in profit and loss, the optionality that is included in the ED, is too permissive. Those are the main points I wanted to raise in that section. Are there any questions on the comments on mechanics of the overlay approach?
I think a relatively minor one. The first point you highlighted in the section was the comment about differing feedback about whether the application of the overlay was sufficiently clear. Is that something that you feel that the staff looking at the comment letters believe that we can address relatively easily?
We do intend to bring a paper on that.
Okay.
I would have thought guidance and examples, but I don't want to go through it too much. We're definitely
going
to bring
it
back. Yeah.
My sense, but I just want to confirm this, is that you see it. Well, some people had comments. You don't see this as a major barrier identifying a fundamental problem with
No, me. No. No, in fact, we said in the basis that, you know, people could do this differently, but we don't. And I personally think, yeah, some examples and guidance will help a lot. But we'll
next month we'll
go into
that.
So you don't see this as a major?
No, I don't think.
I think we need to highlight also that when some people look at the overlay approach, they notice, for example, the number of disclosures that are proposed for the overlay approach, which is quite significant for those people who are applying the overlay approach, which will highlight transparency, and that there will be line items in the profit and loss and SCI. The question is whether we should mandate that.
Okay, continue.
Okay. Question four, that was about the mechanics of the temporary exemption, and the responses are discussed in paragraphs 24 to 45. And this topic attracted more comment than any of the others. Nearly all the respondents that supported the temporary exemption recommended changes to increase the number of entities that would qualify for temporary exemption. Very often that's because they said, well, entities that I consider to be insurers wouldn't get into this. And so quite a lot of constituents suggested changes to the predominance calculation, which would have the effect of increasing the number of entities that could apply the temporary exemption. There were mixed views on the extent to which the eligibility criteria for temporary exemption should be quantitative. Some said we should also have some qualitative criteria. Several suggested that if an entity is regulated as insurer, we should presume that its business is predominantly insurance. Most regulators supported assessing predominance at reporting entity level, i.e. not to allow IAS 39 and IFRS 9 to be applied in a single set of financial statements. Many constituents, other than regulators, wanted entities, particularly financial conglomerates with significant banking activities, to be able to perform a predominance assessment below the level of reporting entity. Many argued that the level playing field that this afforded to subsidiaries in the banking group and subsidiaries in some other sort of group, the benefits of that consistency and level playing field outweighed the issues and concerns of applying IAS 39 and IFRS 9 in a single set of financial statements. And you also see here they thought one could get around some of the problems of applying both of those standards through disclosure. And I think those are even though this was the biggest section of all the letters, often taking many pages, but those are the main bits I wanted to highlight and turn it over to the board if they've got comments or questions about things.
This comment, which is in paragraph 34, about supporting the idea of going below the reporting entity level to give a better understanding of the performance and the fact that the users assess performance of a bank insurance group, not as a whole, but the banking side and the insurance part being assessed separately. It's probably true, but I don't see why a segment reporting in a bank insurance group could not be presented in a way such that the insurance sector, if there is one, would report its performance under IFRS 8 based on IAS 39, IAS 39 as before, to be comparable with other insurance groups that would benefit from the deferral. And then the overlay approach would upgrade those, or take this up to the consolidated level with the overlay adjustment to make it consistent with IFRS 9, but still the performance of the insurance activity would be presented and analyzed as it was before under IAS 39 until the point where they apply IFRS 4. So I don't buy the argument about this segment information not being useful if the group doesn't qualify for the deferral. I don't understand it.
Philippe, I couldn't quite follow.
Well,
could you repeat it?
A bank insurance group, say I've got one here, I'm not going to use the name, but it's a large bank which has an insurance activity fully consolidated. The bank will not qualify for deferral, and it has an insurance segment which represents 12% of the gross profit or net income.
Yeah.
That is a segment. It could be presented as a segment in segment information under IAS 39 fully.
Yeah.
That segment information would be comparable to other insurance companies or insurance groups. Then, in consolidating that segment into the full consolidated statements, which would be under IFRS 9, the overlay adjustment would transform
this IS-39 data into IFRS 9 data for consolidation, but still all the segment information for the insurance part would be comparable with whatever they want to compare to, i.e. other insurance companies or past years, past periods. So I don't understand the argument which was put forward regarding segment information.
I'd agree with Philippe's observation, and you're using the example of segments, so it's not necessarily a separate legal entity
as well.
And similarly, even if we stay at the reporting entity level, if you had, I don't know, two subsidiaries, one a banking subsidiary and one an insurance subsidiary, the insurance subsidiary could, assuming it met the predominance test, however it's drafted, qualify for the deferral in that insurance subsidiary's accounts and then prepare nine information in the consolidated accounts. And obviously that comes with costs, but then it's up to an entity to decide whether or not that comparability is important enough to them, given their peer group, to decide to incur that cost. So in a sense, we've put that cost-benefit assessment within their control. But you're right, I think, Philippe, that they could still provide that information. So we're not preventing them from being comparable.
Apart from the comparability, what about the volatility and mismatch arguments? So if you just did it in the segment and then brought in IFRS 9 and the consolidated, wouldn't the mismatches volatility flow through to your consolidated accounts?
It would, but I think, sorry, Hans. The other thing I think that I was going to say before Philippe spoke was that I think part of the reason why we're getting so much feedback from, notably from particular segments, preparers in particular, that they would like a below the reporting entity level approach is because obviously it maximises the ability to defer, so fewer people have to apply IFRS 9. But I think they're also overlooking the fact that we really think the overlay approach is a better way in those circumstances to deal with the mismatch. So yes, you're right, there could be significant mismatches, but that's why personally I think we need the overlay approach for exactly these types of entities. But because they don't want to use that, they're pushing for this other alternative.
But you take care of it through the overlay approach and consolidation.
Exactly. Yeah. But you still have a mismatch in equity.
Yeah.
Because the overlay just transfers the volatility from P&L to OCI, so the equity is affected by the mismatch. But to be a real problem, it would have to be very big in comparison to the banking activities.
Yeah.
So if a group has 10%, 12%, 15%, 20% of its activities in insurance, part of which, by the way, will not be affected by IFRS 9, and it's only those assets which fall in fair value P&L, that would create the volatility. It would really need to be very big in comparison to the banking activities consolidated to really make a problem in the equity of that bank insurance group. So
yeah, I think I'd like to highlight as well that the discussion can sometimes be below the reporting entity and at the reporting entity level, and whether it's one or the other, mutually exclusive decisions. But I'd like to point out that a lot of the comment letters actually want both.
Yeah.
It's not that they want one or the other. They want both to be applicable because for a group that qualifies at the reporting entity level, it is less costly for them than going below the reporting entity, like having to split up and saying, well, that little entity there, that applies IAS 39, that one applies IFRS 9, and then bring it all up. So you're actually getting, they want both, if possible, quite a lot in some of the letters.
Yeah, but just to finish, if we were to accept that different accounting at the segment or reporting entity and below reporting entity level without having the overlay, just consolidate two different sets of data in one single consolidated balance sheet and income statement, how do you get transparency? You are aggregating in the balance sheet financial assets which are classified and measured under at least two or three or four different ways under IFRS 9 plus four ways under IAS 39, so in combination, it's quite a number of combinations to the classification and measurement, quite complex, and you get transparency only if you have columns in the balance sheet showing those under IFRS 9 and those under IAS 39, or if you present a full balance sheet of that segment which is under IAS 39 and show how it integrates into the consolidation, which is quite heavy in terms of information, quite costly too. So I think there is a trade-off between the understandability and the transparency and the argument for the cost, etc.
Very good.
Well, what's few, okay. the brief describe is already covered in paper 3.
Sorry?
It's already in 14C. Do you capture the idea that Philippe
just described?
Yes, we mentioned what the conclusions would be of the staff as a package, what could happen. And that could be, we don't talk about settlement reporting, but we talk about those entities that could not qualify for the temporary devil, could easily use the overlay approach if they wish.
So what Philippe described is, you know, if reporting entity level, they will use, you know, overlay approach.
Yes.
And they will be on the same basis. But for segmental reporting, you know, the insurance sectors
could
segment.
They could choose to.
They could choose to.
It's optional.
We don't need to change anything because segmental reporting today allows you to do that.
That's right. Yeah. No, but it is important because I heard, you know, similar views from Chinese industry, particularly.
Right.
You know, one type of at the insurance company, you know,
sure.
They have maybe 40% insurance, another 40% banking, and they feel, you know, what Philippe described, it will be very useful.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say that we allowed to do so, but they want us to clearly say so, you know.
It's in the standard in segment reporting.
Well, we could remind it in the.
We could make it clear.
They want us to make it clear.
Yeah. We can make it clear.
And some of the debate will go. Yes.
Yeah.
Companies do that today.
Yep.
Through the eyes of management, a different approach.
Yeah. No, I agree. We can make it clear.
But I'm not sure if comparability is their main issue that they just use it as an argument. Martin.
And also comment with this argument of level playing field because. When we started this project and saying, okay, we want to have maybe this deferral for pure insurers and not for this bank insurers, conglomerates. So these people who commented really on to have it below the reporting entity level maybe should also disagree with our overall purpose to do it only for pure insurers. They want to do it really for bank conglomerates. And I think we have to think then in relation with what users have told us in 14B, because I think they want to have comparable information. And based on my knowledge is what analysts and others are doing, then comparing banks with banks and insurers with insurers. And I think many of these bank insurers are compared with banks and not with insurers. And I think that is key. And then the question is, what is the level playing field? Is then the level playing field that these bank insurers are then compared with partly IAS 39 information on the consolidated balance sheet with pure banks, which then have to apply full IFRS 9. Next step is then banks will come out. What is the level playing field with us?
Yeah.
And therefore, I think it is really difficult. And I think that was a reason why we said, okay, maybe we are convinced by the argument which was cost and volatility then for the pure insurers, but not really for other kind of, I don't know, in Germany we have Daimler and other car industries which have insurance, banking and car producing. And should they also qualify for that? Because they're also conglomerates with different business models.
Yeah.
And all the car manufacturers in Germany have insurance and have also banking.
But if they use the segment standard as it applies and used IAS 39 in the segment report on insurance and then applied the overlay approach in consolidation, which is what I think
they can deal then with the volatility, right? Yeah.
I just maybe a quick point of for clarification. My understanding in terms of those who felt uncomfortable about the overlay approach was the need to retain both IFRS 9 information and IAS 39 information at the same time, so they would
That's
need both sets
of
information.
Yeah.
Those who are proposing below the level, below the reporting level, and I think you cover it in paragraph 34, suggest in paragraph 34 that the problem is taken away or they can resolve the issue, both because it is short term and by, and I think the words you've got here, disclosing the effects of applying both IAS 39 and IFRS 9. So it seems to me that they are suggesting that they would need to get that information or that they have that information available. In kind of making the suggestion that they would now disclose the difference between IAS 39 and IFRS 9, did they suggest how they would disclose it? Was the intention that they were going to disclose it qualitatively rather than quantitatively, or?
I thought it was quantitative, but I don't remember seeing exactly how they would do that. But that's, they just said we could get around this
by disclosing the difference.
Have I got that wrong?
I think that's correct, but I think we need to be mindful that some of have written you've only proposed two disclosures for the temporary exemption, and some preparers are objecting to that already.
That was going to be my second question. Yes. Paragraph 45 says they don't want to disclose it,
so,
and paragraph 34 suggests that that's how they'll solve it.
And so I think Connor's right. They give this statement, and I think in a way they're thinking maybe that those two disclosures that was already proposed is enough, because they don't then back up and saying, and we will do this and this. They're probably thinking, I would say, reading a little bit literally, is that whatever was proposed in the ED, well, we can do that. Nothing wrong with that.
Certainly, and it comes a little bit to, I think, the way Martin and Philippe were talking about it, is that the way to reflect what the effects are, to my mind, is almost show what your results would be under IS 39 and your results under IFRS 9, which then seems to have taken me all the way back to the beginning, which is what the overlay approach is proposing.
Yeah. No, I don't.
Sorry?
You need both.
Do you mean to say that you will have to have two systems anyway?
What I'm saying is, if I follow their suggestion,
yeah,
which is in order that people can understand a set of financial statements prepared under mixed, they are suggesting that they would disclose the difference between IAS 39 and IFRS 9.
Which means that you need
to do that, you have to have both sets of information. If you've got both sets of information, it seems to me you're back in the overlay approach.
Yeah. I think they were probably thinking something quite high level, probably along the lines of what the ED proposed, and no more.
Come on, shall we? So I now propose to consider questions 5 and 6 together, and the responses to these questions are discussed in paragraphs 46 to 49. Question 5 asks whether the overlay approach and the temporary exemption should be optional. And most agree that they both should be optional. That was not a controversial question. Question 6 asked if there should be a fixed expiry date for the temporary exemption, and if so, whether the exemption should expire as proposed in the ED, for reporting periods beginning on or after the 1st of January 2021. Some, mostly preparers, did not support the proposed fixed expiry date because they believe that the insurers should initially apply for S9 at the same time of the new standard. Basically, the switchover should be conditional on the new standard being available. Others do support that an expiry date, either because they don't want the implementation of IFRS 9 for all entities to be delayed any further, or implicitly or explicitly, they expect that the new standard would be available by 2021, so they were sort of happy with that as the expiry date. Any the board have any questions or comments on the optionality and the expiry date?
Gary?
And, I think it's important to have a fixed expiry date. Now we have a debate, should it be 2021 or another date, and I agree with, we've got to get the IFRS 4 redo sort of largely written before we finalize that, but I think dates organize work, and they come up with project plans and developing resources towards it, but it's open-ended. First thing, that's putting aside all of the benefits of having a target date, we're going to have to reopen the subject sometime down the line. I mean, and it's not in, whether it's a year from now, 3 years now, whenever it is, to pick that date is, I think, since we're going to be inviting an exposure draft, you're going to be inviting more, you know, disagreement with elements of the standard. So I think we're better off picking it sooner rather than later. And for all the other reasons I said, I think it's important, you know, that we actually set the date.
Pat?
On this issue of the date, I find it to be a bit illogical from the standpoint that if you look down the road and let's say your date is 2021 today, and you get to 2020 and it's going to take us another year, it's almost inevitable, for the same reasons that you bought into why you gave the industry a deferral in 2016, why you wouldn't extend another year, or maybe another 2 years, okay? For all the reasons that some people around the table here seem to be quite empathetic to. So in my mind, yes, Gary, you're absolutely right. Setting dates, in theory, cracks the whip. But we all know how standard setting works. And it's not the same way as the world works. So I think it just should be noted that use of a date or the lack of a date is not, I think, going to change ultimately this board's decision. If you're going to give them a deferral now, you're going to give it to them when you're a year away or 2 years away, for all the same reasons.
I could largely agree with Pat, but two things persuade me that I wouldn't oppose a fixed date. One is psychologically, or whatever, I think it might be a good thing, and that's sort of part of your idea, Gary, of a target. And secondly, I don't see it doing any harm. So on those two bases, I would support it.
Yeah. Okay. And finally, in addition to the six questions asked in the ED, constituents raised two other concerns, which are discussed in paragraphs 50 to 54. One was whether first-time adopters of IFRS should be able to apply the overlay approach and the temporary exemption. And the other concern, accounting for associates and joint ventures accounts. When the associates would be eligible for the temporary exemption in their separate financial statements, but the group would not be eligible for temporary exemption in its group accounts, though they account for these entities on the equity method. These were... Yeah, the first-time adopters, we got several letters from Italy and two from Singapore. And the JV and associates was some for Far East, but also one large insurer but based in France who would be affected. Does the board have any questions or comments on these additional points?
Something we need to look at.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't think they're critical path for making the main decisions, but I think they're valid points that are worth considering, you know, whether we align first-time adoption with whatever package we decide. And I had some sympathy with the associates' point, because I think our thinking around consistency of accounting policy doesn't line up with our thinking about the definition of a group, which is a broader question, but it's, given it's particularly stressed here, I think it's worth looking at.
Sure, we have it on the project plan.
Yeah, I saw that, but just off of that comment.
Yeah, and I agree with that, because I think that for me, and I'll be interested obviously to see the staff's analysis, but I think that the additional complexity that might come from having a combination of 39 and 9 accounting if you were to take a reporting entity level approach is quite different if you're talking about accounting for an associate where you've got a sort of one line type approach, and I'd be interested to see that analysis.
I think you meant below the reporting entity
approach. I meant below the reporting entity.
Can I go back and ask a question on expiry date? I was at a meeting where I can't recall now exactly who said it, but somebody said that even though they want deferral, they would actually plan to apply IFRS 9 before the new insurance standard in order to be able to restate comparatives. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, IFRS 9 doesn't allow the comparative restatement. So in the year you adopt the insurance standard, there is actually an advantage in adopting IFRS 9 1 year early in order then to have a proper reset and you get all the comparatives. And when you apply it at that point for IFRS 9, you know exactly what the new insurance standard looks like. You can do all your business model assessments and all the rest of it in the light of that. Was that a comment that came out elsewhere, or is it just a one-off throwaway comment that I heard?
9 does allow restatement of comparatives, but there's some restrictions around it, so I can see why they might want to come in early.
Yeah. It wasn't raised in the comment letters.
I heard the same thing, and I just don't know whether I was in the same meeting.
I think it's fair to say, though, that you did hear positive support to the idea of them being able to stop applying the deferral at any point of time earlier than this 2021. So maybe it's kind of embedded in that idea that you can stop at any point of time.
Which would de facto create one more year.
That was partly why I said it.
if that's a nightmare scenario comes out, that will still be good. Okay. Let's go to the next.
Yeah, so we move to agenda paper 14B that summarizes the feedback from users that the board in France have received. The outreach that we have performed was during the comment letter period and supplements the outreach that was performed during summertime last year when we have been developing the proposals for the exposure draft. In total, we have reached out to approximately 100 users of financial statements from different jurisdictions and following different entities. We have discussed also those proposals with groups. For example, at the end of February, we have discussed it with CMEC. We have also received some comment letters. We have also received a comment letter from CRAF. I'm planning to discuss the whole paper in sections, similarly to what Connor did, and ask questions or comments after each section. And I might say, like, as a general comment, that interestingly we will have different views from users comparing to preparers to make our discussion a bit more interesting. And I think in general, the views that we have heard in this outreach comparing to previous one, we've heard on a high level similar messages, but we also did dig a little bit deeper because we did ask them questions about additional details in the exposure draft. And also I would like to say that in terms of the CRAFT and CMEC, I think their views were mostly in line with majority of the users. So whenever I'm saying that most or majority of the users said that, that's most likely that the CMEC and CRAFT was in agreement with that. We have received actually quite mixed views about whether.
But my recollection from the CMEC meeting was that there was almost no support for deferral at all.
Yes,
and not at all. And whereas the other users seem to be, at least some of them seem to be a bit more sympathetic.
Yes, but in essence, most users would be those or many users that didn't like the deferral. So. The CRAFT and CMEC was in agreement with many or most users.
So the CMEC was not more extreme
than everyone
else. If you want to call that extreme, but more anti-deferral than others.
I think they were more anti, yes.
Does many comprise a majority?
It's a semantics, but many is more than half, definitely.
Okay, because paragraph 38 says many users of financial statements did not support any deferral of IFRS 9, just to clarify Hans's point. So the majority did not support the deferral approach.
Yes.
Well, more than half, definitely. That's actually quite a
that's
few.
A majority.
We're picking on this in part because when we did the conceptual feedback, conceptual framework this morning, what Rachel laid out about how they used the same terms was slightly different. So they used
different comparisons.
Yeah, they used many when it was less than a majority.
Okay.
And so they, you know, when it was so just. Heads up when you're using these words that we have to retune from this morning.
I think I didn't use majority. I was using many or most.
Right.
I think and most
so
is stronger.
The conceptual framework said few.
Right.
Is
handful.
Handful.
Yes.
Some is less than majority. Many is more than majority.
Was it? Okay.
And most is.
Okay.
I think it's the same way you.
Okay.
Our intention was to be entirely consistent
yeah.
between
good.
Those
okay.
two projects.
Okay. I thought I had remembered many being there and then most being above.
And so now we give you bright lines.
Okay.
Okay.
Qualitative.
Let's ask the Koreans to do a study on
it.
I think it could help.
Okay. So. Going to the summary of the feedback, we have actually some users that were concerned about this not alignment of the effective dates of IFRS 9 and the forthcoming insurance contract standard, but many of them were also not concerned about it. And the reason why they weren't concerned, especially about the additional volatility, was because they thought that they do not only focus on the profit or loss, there are other metrics that they are using. So just difference in the one metrics wouldn't make a lot of, wouldn't make them concerned about it. Some are also saying that the volatility currently exists, they can cope with it today. Some also assess that the additional volatility should not be significant. But some users thought that the additional volatility could be actually problematic for them. They thought that that might make insurance industry appear less attractive for the investment because more uncertain. In terms of the proposed approaches, many respondents actually didn't feel that we don't need to do anything. They thought that because, first of all, they thought that they were not concerned about this not alignment at all. Some of them were saying actually it's just not worth to do anything because the benefits of doing anything is actually lower than the cost of just confusing people during this short period of time. In terms of the fact that we proposed two approaches to be optional, they thought that this actually might be confusing. It's just too many options which might decrease comparability. So they would prefer us to propose only one approach, and it would be the best if we just do it mandatorily. Many users actually believe that the overlay approach is a better approach. This is because they thought it preserves comparability and it addresses the volatility problem in a transparent way. And many users didn't support the deferral approach because they thought that actually it introduces lack of comparability and it reduces information content for those entities that will apply the deferral approach. And the deferral approach was supported by some users from Europe, Canada, and Asia, and especially those that follow mainly insurance entities because they were not so concerned about the cross-section comparability. So before I will get into the details of both overlay and the deferral, I'll stop here and ask if you have any questions or comments on this part.
Pat?
I think a key point that I took away from some of these discussions was, and this addresses a point I think that Daryl made earlier, the volatility that, say, arises from reporting equities under IFRS 9 through P&L versus if you choose the IFRS approach today, exists. Okay, it exists today. It's reported in equity. We have a solution for that. We have the overlay approach where you can keep it in equity, in OCI. When you adopt the new insurance contract standard, if you're selling par contracts, well, you're going to have an offset in your P&L because when you sell participating contracts, the policyholder is essentially going to be absorbing some of that change in asset value, that volatility. The excess, the shareholder share, the insurance company's portion of it is going to be in the contractual service margin, so it doesn't hit P&L there, comes out over time. So you have, obviously, a solution now with the overlay approach, and that volatility will be dealt with through the new insurance contracts model. Now, if you're selling non-par contracts and you're holding a significant amount of equities, you're going to have some volatility, but that's real economic volatility, right? We can't do anything about that. But we chose this path because we said it provides better information. Mm-hmm. The FASB chose the exact same path, too, to report equities through P&L. So I think, you know, when you step back and you ask yourself, well, what are the consequences of this? The investors don't get the better information that we've said is available through the expected credit loss model. We spent years developing that model because we said it's going to provide better information. And there are a number of insurers that hold billions of dollars of loans to retail customers as well as to banks. Billions of dollars. And that information is not going to make its way into the financial statements. And we've stood on ceremony. We've made a big deal about how important this expected credit loss information is. And yet we're going to allow them a pass, not but just for a couple of years, but at least three or four, and possibly,
well,
who knows?
If it's up to you, we wouldn't have an
if it's up to me, it wouldn't happen. Okay? If it's up to me, it wouldn't happen. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think we have solutions here that are quite reasonable relative to the cost. The benefits far exceed the costs. There's no question in my mind. And the investors have made that abundantly clear. They've voted very clearly in all these meetings.
Okay. Martin?
Yeah, on this arguments, paragraph 24 following. Some users of financial statements are not concerned about increased volatility. Clearly, but the point is not about volatility, the point is accounting mismatches. And that we have, I think the preparers said, okay, they have now that, okay, some of the assets have to be more fair value P&L, but then the liability side is not moving current value, that is their concern. It is not increased volatility. And if you then read 24, it is saying, the first group of users saying, okay, they are not concerned about volatility because they don't use the P&L at all. Now, clearly, then you do not be concerned. Second said, okay, that are specialists and they are not second group are specialist users and they also don't not concerned. But then example is because they are from Australia and they have both sides already on fair value P&L. Yeah, clearly, then you are not concerned. And then it goes on because I think that is not to the point. And have we spoken to really to the users and asking them, are they concerned about accounting mismatches and volatility from that or from volatility at all? Because man, this paragraph 24, 25, 26 doesn't convince me.
Why wouldn't the overlay approach address that?
Because the preparers are concerned about volatility, and based on my experience, if you have accounting volatility, analysts and users are concerned because they want to predict what is your run rate, what is your constant earnings. They don't want to have this accounting noise in your earnings, because if you have that, they're asking you the question, can you please give me the number without this accounting noise? And that is the reason why many now trying to give non-GAAP measures, because then they want to have this kind of what is then the run rate earnings and not this volatility.
Wouldn't the overlay approach point out to them where the volatility comes from?
Yeah, because at least, okay, that some of that, okay, would then, I think that the overlay approach says that under IAS 39, this assets which are not fair valued, but has to be fair valued, that at least has to be come down because that can be charged or be recognized then in OCI. That is the overlay approach. And if you have then about many insurers, at least in Europe, if you have a cost measure on the liability side and have a cost measure on the asset side, that is at least a cost measure on both sides, and would avoid that you have a fair value measure on the asset side, but a cost measure on the liability side. And clearly, the overlay approach would address it.
I'll answer your question. Your question in the middle of all of that was, the paragraphs here talk about volatility, and were they really meaning?
Yeah.
Did they understand we were investigating accounting mismatches? And I think the answer to that question is yes, despite the wording that's used in the paper. And the reason why I'm confident giving you that answer is because the whole tee-up for the presentation that we went through with the users of financial statements was explaining what it was that was changing between IAS 39 and IFRS 9 and stepping the investors through the fact that why the concern of preparers was that it was temporary because of the future alignment they hoped would offset a lot of it because of the change in the accounting for the insurance contract liability. So even though we've used the generic term volatility, I think they understood.
But I would question that, because, but Sue, if you're reading these articles here, or these paragraphs here, it's saying that based on experience from people from Canada, from Australia, which have the liability side already on a current measure. And then my question is, if they understood how, if they have the liability side already on current, if then the asset comes also on current.
And I think that's
that would reduce. It would then reduce accounting mismatches and not increase.
Yeah, but we also did talk to a lot of users in Europe where they are used to mismatches.
Okay, but then here's the examples.
Yeah, so I wouldn't use these examples as the basis for all of the statements.
Yes, I think it's fair to say, I agree with Sue that the presentation was quite clear. And I think when we say additional volatility, it means might be additional mismatches as well. So I think from the presentation that we had that is actually attached to the back of the document, I think it's quite clear from the pictures that it might come as accounting mismatches as well. In terms of the profit or loss only, I think it would be fair to say that it's not that they are not using profit or loss at all, but profit or loss is just one of the metrics that they are using, and it's just one of the metrics that it is changing. So again, it's not that they do not care because they are not using that at all, but they have other metrics that they take into account, and the profit or loss is not the only one that they they do look at.
But sorry to say that, man, if it is accounting mismatches, but then they're saying we don't focus on the P&L, but we're looking at cash flows and ability to pay dividends and non-GAAP measures, man, how can you find out accounting mismatches from this stuff? I don't have any clue.
I think you look at that stuff partly because they know that today in accounting, in the P&L, that are already accounting mismatches,
yes,
because in many cases the liabilities are at cost, and not all of the assets are at cost because there are assets there which cannot be measured at cost. So they know that already today there is accounting mismatches in P&L, and that's why they're driven to look at non-GAAP measures, other measures of that will avoid the accounting mismatches.
So as a type, it's nothing new. It already exists. It might be just a little bit more.
Stephen.
I think they are well aware of the mismatches today, and I think in many of the meetings that I was at, there was a lot of complaints about the whole system at the moment and the poor quality of insurance contract accounting, and many people, without us prompting, urged us to get the other project done as soon as possible. In terms of my observations from the meetings, I think most of the generalists, the non-insurance specialists that I spoke to, were very much against the deferral, and they were split between either do nothing or the overlay. But the specialists, some of them did want the deferral, and often the reason was, I don't want to change my models twice. And
that sounds familiar.
Yeah. And then they would say, yes, but, or the ones that sort of really appreciated what IFRS 9 was doing, and we did some education, but some perhaps were not as familiar with IFRS 9 as perhaps others. But those that were familiar with IFRS 9 would often then say, but I want all the disclosures from IFRS 9. So give me that, but then don't make me change my models twice. And then there were others of the specialists that really, really did understand what they might get out of IFRS 9 and then wanted it in the financial statements as soon as possible because they thought that would then better give them information, and they seemed to be less concerned about having to change their models twice. So that there was a range, and it's because people come from a different perspective and think about firstly their models, or firstly think about the information that they might get out of IFRS 9.
Mary?
Steve, on that point about cost of changing models, when we had the meeting with our capital markets advisory committee, and I can't remember if you were there for that, because we'd heard about concerns about costs for users in terms of change, you know, their change in model, understanding two rounds of change, etc., you know, we did ask CMAC members, who are one group of users, not authoritative representatives for the whole, about the cost concern from their perspective rather than the preparer's perspective. It was interesting to me that the CMAC members were very dismissive of that in terms of the cost to them in changing their models. Their view was that, you know, there, like it or not, the reality is ongoing change in each year from both an accounting perspective, but also many of the companies they follow making regular accounting, you know, voluntary changes that they have to adjust their models for, and so a level of change is just part of their reality. And said, you know, at least the people at CMAX said that the cost of to them users of changing was, in their view, something that didn't warrant consideration.
I think that's fair. Within CMAX, I don't think there's one that is building insurance company models.
Okay.
There are those who are building models for other sectors, and there are those who are in a management position and are overseeing people that are building insurance models. But I think you're right, they were fairly dismissive of this notion of not doing this because you change your models twice. And I mean, one observed that she changes her models every year because things happen and segments change, and that's part of the process of being an analyst, is to change models.
I was going to come in when Martin was talking about the profit and loss, but I think, and then I think the topic moved on. But I think it's similar to this issue that you've raised, Mary. I think the nature of IFRS 4 at the moment, particularly the fact that it allows quite a lot of very different practices, and that sometimes it allows those different practices in the same set of financial statements, means from my understanding anyway, the changes to models, the updating of the models, is quite a lot more intensive than it might be in other industries. Essentially what you're trying to do in many cases is use the base information for the liabilities and then remodel what you think the total performance would be. And I think often that is a tie back to other sources of information like embedded value and the like, which I think also answers to an extent Martin's question about why the profit and loss is an indicator but is not an absolute amount here, because you spend a lot of time as an analyst looking at insurance companies and looking at what the liability would have been if it had been measured differently, what the assets would have been if they'd been measured on the same basis as the liability. So I think this is a little bit of a different environment, and so Steve's point about how many insurance models there are in CMAQ, I think becomes quite important. It's a little bit different to other space where it's sort of incremental changes, or particularly updating your history rather than updating the whole way your model determines value.
Okay, Isa, continue.
Okay, so let's move to the details of the overlay approach. I think in general, users support the way we design the overlay approach, and they particularly like disclosures that we propose. There were mixed views on the proposed flexibility of the presentation. More users would prefer us to mandate presentation, and they would prefer us to mandate the presentation that is showing IFRS 9 information in the profit or loss with clear distinction or clear line items that is reclassifying the amounts to the OCI, and they would like to see all the explanations about the effects of the overlay approach in the notes. So in essence, that was quite simple, that they like the overlay approach. But I will stop here just to make sure to ask if you have any questions or comments on the details of the overlay approach.
Nope.
Okay. In terms of the deferral approach, considering that most users did not favor the deferral approach, we asked them about the views on the deferral if we propose it. Most of users would prefer deferral approach to be at the reporting entity level, and this was mainly because they didn't like the negative effects of going below the reporting entity, especially they mentioned that it would be confusing if we had in the one set of financial statements financial assets being measured using two different accounting standards. They would though prefer us to consider how to make sure that the entities that are considered peers within the same insurance sector would be comparable. They did note that it might be difficult because especially with financial conglomerates, there are entities that users might view them differently. But even though they did want us to consider especially the changes to the eligibility criteria, for example, they said that if an entity has liabilities related to tax, which doesn't say whether it's an insurance entity or not, doesn't differentiate, we should make sure that this kind of liability should not disqualify them from using the deferral approach. They also did know that quite a lot of insurance entities are providing asset management services, and we should consider how to make sure that those entities should be within the scope as well. But it's worth saying that most of the users were very uncomfortable of us providing any kind of deferral for the banking activity that is significant. As was noticed, I think, before, many users were concerned about the missing information, especially IFRS 9 information, and they did mention that they were concerned about the loss of information about credit losses, and they thought that the loss of that information might be not justified, and therefore they requested us to consider more information related to IFRS 9, especially the one related to credit losses.
May I ask a question on that? There's a comment in the other paper that talks about running two systems around this issue. I'm not convinced, based on my experience, that you have to actually run, quote unquote, two accounting systems to provide information about credit losses. I would be surprised today with the volume of lending that insurance companies do in the form of private placements, loans, that they do not have a robust credit function. I mean, it goes part and parcel with the whole process. So it's a matter of gathering that information, right? And whether or not
they have a system that is going to determine a PD in accordance with the revised model under IFRS 9 is another question. But they have to incur this cost anyway. It has to be incurred at some point in time, unless we're going to give the insurance industry a pass here, you know, indefinitely. So it has to be incurred at some point in time. So it's not double counting. It's not incremental. It's not extra. It's actually, okay, a step towards fulfilling that obligation, that need, and delivering valuable information to the marketplace. So I question this whole issue of, you know, maintaining, requiring to run two different systems. And if they do, that's their choice. They've chosen to do that. They've elected to take advantage, if this board provides the deferral, that path. So as you were just saying, this is going to create a loss of significant information if those systems aren't robust enough to provide an adequate response to
that. Pat, are you talking about, because you mentioned at the end there deferral, are you talking about those insurers who choose to do the deferral?
Yes.
Or those investors who choose to do the overlay? Because I think they're two different issues
deferral.
As far as the
deferral.
Cost is
deferral.
Concerned.
Deferral.
Okay, so you're talking about then retaining additional information under the deferral approach for disclosure.
Yes.
Okay.
For cost, for expected losses. Yeah.
Okay.
So
I certainly agree with Pat that we're really talking about a timing issue, because sooner or later these guys are going to have to apply IFRS 9, so it's not a, you know, cost of a avoidable, if you like, it's just a timing question. But I think the point that they would probably make in terms of the two systems points is that if they were providing IAS 39 information in their actual financial statements using an incurred loss model and then had to provide IFRS 9 expected loss disclosures, they would have to calculate two types of impairment numbers for the period of the deferral, which I think is their two systems point. And I do agree with you that one would hope that that insurance companies are good credit risk managers, so they should have good information about credit risks and credit losses and be thinking about fair values as well, which is part of the, you know, same set of information. But I think where, again, it is timing, but I think the reality of us asking them for disclosures about IFRS 9 impairment, even when they defer, would be that they would have to make the systems changes to enable them to make the assessment of significant increases in credit risk, which is a unique concept for IFRS 9.
Absolutely.
And they would have to do the calculations in a way that met the objectives of IFRS 9, which they could, you know, use existing credit risk systems and information as a basis. But they certainly wouldn't just be able to pick up existing stuff and use it for disclosures,
right,
which I think is what they're focusing on.
But that wouldn't create incremental costs, in my view.
It brings the cost forward.
Exactly.
Relative to what they're hoping
for. That's right. And the benefits of that exceed the costs, in my view, particularly in a market that we've seen in the last year that's undergoing significant question marks around, you know, the quality of credit.
Piece of the information I wanted to share with you is the optional versus mandatory and the expiry date. So as I noted before, users thought that the two optional approaches might just be confusing, especially for the short period of time. So therefore, they liked mandatory proposals better than the optional. However, some noted that if we do mandatory proposal, especially related to the deferral, that might mean that some entities will not be able to apply IFRS 9, which is not a desired effect. Some also thought that actually they expect that there will be market discipline. So even if we don't do it mandatory, as the entities that are considered peers, they are likely to do similar things. In terms of the expiry date, almost all users emphasize that it is important to have the expiry date. And this is because the deferral can be only accepted if it's for short period of time, and that expiry date will actually emphasize that this is only a temporary solution. Some were though concerned that even if we propose this expiry date, we might have a difficulties to uphold it, especially if there will be a delaying the insurance contract standard.
Any questions?
Any further questions? No, then I...
Well,
sorry, could I ask one about the user feedback overall? asking cautiously because I apparently am misremembering things. You said at the beginning that this is just the user feedback, and I think, Connor, you said that the paper A included regulators.
You did.
So the regulators who responded were captured in paper A. And if you, I don't know if you can do this from memory, if you take, Connor, your recollection of the feedback that we got from regulators that was included in A, was it more consistent with the user views that we see in B?
I think it depends on which question. And so you've got the summary here.
Yeah.
But also we summarize it in the executive summary on paper 14C.
Okay.
So we highlight, for example, that regulators were kind of like, okay, there might be some concerns, address those concerns. We're okay with temporary exemption and the overlay approach. If you do the temporary exemption, it was consistent comments, stay at the reporting entity level. So most of the regulators said that strongly. Mm. Most of them agreed that perhaps we have captured the maybe too narrow a subset of entities they considered insurers. They asked us to look at that again. Again, they agreed with optional, that both approaches should be optional. With the overlay approach, some of them, as Connor mentioned, wanted a little bit more guidance on which assets would apply the overlay approach, a little bit more mandation into the presentation of the line items on the face of the income statement for the overlay approach.
Approximately how many national standard setters did we act?
I think we can look behind. If you look behind on page...
that was just the users. Oh, sorry, the regulators that you were talking about.
If you look at 29, paragraph 20... Page 29 of 14A, and if we can read the standard setters, which is about 20, so it's about 18 maybe.
And how many of those supported the view of the users and the regulators?
Well, I think we got mixed.
They were split.
They were mixed, again, depending which question you ask. So most standard setters said there are issues you need to address. Yes, you should go for a temporary exemption and the overlay approach. There was one or two notable standard setters that said, no, you shouldn't do the temporary exemption at all. I think from Latin America and from the ASBJ in Japan. And then when you came to the mechanics of it, again, you got the overlay approach. Some people didn't comment, but some would say, well, perhaps you should mandate
guidance. In Europe, was there any national standard setter who supported whom? In terms of not going below the entity
yes.
level.
Yes. Yes, we did.
France. Yes. Germany and Italy.
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 Yes.
Okay.
But again, to be clear, the standard setters in Europe are supporting, most of them support both.
An overlay and a deferral.
Yeah. The overlay and a deferral, but also reporting entity level, both at the reporting entity level and below.
Yeah, but Italy and Germany did not.
Well, they were stronger to say it should be at the reporting.
Germany said agree with top level, but open to investigating below.
Yeah.
I think Italy said no, just at
the reporting entity level.
Okay. But others did say go below.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's reflective as well of the feedback from
outside
Europe.
Okay, but that means that EFREC was not unanimous.
Yes.
First of all, the observers were against going below the entity level.
Yes.
Mm. And two of the national standard setters, and I suppose some other members were also not favorable to. Okay.
Mary, did that answer
your
question?
That did.
Thank you. And the expiry date also, they were more consistent with the users. They thought this can only go on for so long. Yeah.
The clarification about the regulator's view. In this case, I think particularly relevant that is the insurance regulator may have different views, you know, against the security regulator.
That's right. The IIS, their members were split about the predominance assessment.
They were the only one who sat on the fence.
Yeah, all the others were.
All the other securities and prudential regulators said reporting entity level. And one interesting comment was the banking regulators were not unduly concerned about some bits of banking business being swept in as a result of being at the reporting entity level, and even went so far as saying that they would be open to us being a little bit more permissive in terms of how we would describe the reporting entity level test.
Yeah.
which was interesting.
Banking regulators in which area?
Basel.
And
Europe. We've got two letters from European regulators.
Now, I got a feeling if we make it clear, as Philippe described, some of the concern already come.
Some maybe, but not all.
Of course, not always.
So can I just go back a step? We're talking about the different options here. Prudential, meaning insurance, banking, securities regulators. I know what IOSCO said. Did they support or oppose a deferral? Forget about
it. They support it.
So all these regulators supported a deferral?
Yes.
Yeah. At the reporting entity level.
Some not as wholeheartedly as others, but...
Reading a motion into security.
Yeah, okay, maybe, sorry.
Okay, I propose we break until 2:45, and then... Okay, we resume our meeting, and I give the floor to Joanna.
Right, we're now going on to Agenda Paper 14C. And Agenda Paper 14C asks for key decisions that will set the direction for the board's redeliberations on this project, and also sets out a project plan for this project. Due to the urgency of this project, staff are asking for key decisions that will focus and shape the staff analysis and the project's deliberations going forwards. As per normal, we will review the package as a whole towards the end of the process. There are five questions set out on page 23, and it is set out as a package of five questions. However, for discussion purposes, what I would suggest is that we break it down according to each of the five questions for discussion. And at the end of the discussion on all the five questions, that we ask for your votes there at the end of the session. And then we will move on to the project, set out the project plan and any questions there. So the first question put to the board is on the temporary exemption itself. It considers in paragraphs 9 to 16 of the paper whether the board should proceed with the temporary exemption from applying IFRS 9, sometimes called the deferral approach. To balance the different constituents' views that we have heard, the staff recommends confirming a temporary exemption that would be available for qualifying entities, but not all entities issuing contracts within the scope of IFRS 4. The main reason being the potential to address accounting mismatches and volatility, and it could be cost effective for the qualifying entities. I'll turn it over for discussion. Question one.
We have already exchanged quite a few of the arguments, of course, but so. Mm-hmm.
Anything further to add, I guess, is the right way to say.
Philippe?
My leaning is to say yes, and yes to all the questions, by the way. But of course, this is not a complete set of information. We still have some work to do on the details of the conditions for the deferral, how the predominance test will be determined, and this is for upcoming meetings. So I think our decisions today can only be tentative and be subject to finding a satisfactory answer to those detailed questions. So I think, in principle, my line is okay with all the questions.
Can I ask a question? And that is, in light of the evidence that we just heard from Connor and Issa, and the fact that clearly within the investor community there isn't support for moving for a deferral, at least that's my takeaway, how did you arrive at your recommendation? How did you, notwithstanding that preponderance of evidence to say don't provide the deferral, you arrove at a conclusion to provide a deferral? But what did you wait?
Well, I think I waited the fact that we consulted widely. So we consulted preparers, auditors, accounting actuarial professionals, national standards, regulators, and users. And we've got to weigh all the constituents' views that we heard. And the majority of those...
Yeah. Well, it's not that simple.
We
often do things that even majority of our constituents do not like. But I think there is also sympathy for the proposal from several board members.
I think we made an exposure draft based on arguments that we had heard in the exposure draft. And there were three concerns that we had heard that we had more sympathy for some than others. I think the comment letters and outreach might have changed the nuance of how we balanced those concerns and which ones we took to answer. But it didn't fundamentally change the fact patterns that led to us proposing the exposure draft in the first place.
I just was surprised when I read your rationale. I thought you were going to essentially come to a conclusion that said a deferral wasn't appropriate. But then the punchline was a deferral is appropriate. And as I said before, we've come up with responses or reasons for not providing a deferral. We have a sound approach, the overlay approach, to deal with volatility to the extent that people believe there's going to be volatility in P&L. We have a need to serve the investors with better information. We have this expected credit loss model, which we spent years on working on. And we're essentially saying that this industry doesn't have to do that. And we've also demonstrated that there are not significant costs, incremental costs here. It's just essentially a timing when those costs never occurred. So when you add it all up, that's one of the problems I have here. To me, the evidence doesn't lead you to this or point you in this direction at all. So, I mean, I'm willing to listen to other board members tell me the basis on which they're voting for this recommendation.
So I agree with Pat in some ways in that this is a very difficult one because it's one of the limited number of cases, I think, where we have such incredibly divergent views between a very big chunk of our constituents and specifically our user views. Perhaps we should have said that before tea time, but it was actually quite striking how different the views were between the two different sets of bodies. And I think in the answer to Mary's question, you pointed out even the regulators have not taken to the same extent as you'd expect the view of the users. For me, there are a couple of things in this, and unfortunately I need to almost stray out of the pure question that you're dealing with here. The starting point is I think that there is a mismatch that is created by there is the potential for a mismatch created by the implementation of IFRS 9 before the fix for IFRS 4. I don't believe it's an insurmountable mismatch, but I think we requiring, in order to fix this mismatch, potential for a lot of changes to existing IFRS 4 reporting, which doesn't necessarily make sense to me if, and we'll come to this issue later, this is a short period of time that we're dealing with. So the first thing for me is I ask, is there actually a real problem here? And I think there is a real problem. I think even some of the users you spoke to acknowledged that there was the real potential for volatility arising from. Having taken that view, we've got two solutions. And for me, the problem at the IFRS 9 level is primarily a problem of mismatch. I don't believe the problem of cost. Again, for the reasons Pat raised and Sue raised earlier, about right this time. I think that the cost of implementing IFRS 9 in 2018 instead of, say, 2020 is simply a deferred cost issue. For that reason, I think the deferral. For that reason, I think we need to resolve the problem. I think we need to pick one of a solution. We need to pick a solution for that. The overlay problem carries with it this issue of the dual running of processes, and I think to an extent that does introduce not as significant a cost as may have been indicated to us, but I think it's a far more significant cost than this idea of simply deferral, because the deferral is just a timing of cost, whereas this has the potential to be a real cost element.
How did you describe that?
The overlay
will
introduce some costs.
Yes.
It's going to introduce some costs over and above, because now it's the cost of both adopting IFRS 9 early, so both the one that we say is less significant, and the cost of running systems to an extent parallel, not to the same extent that people have spoken about. So the overlay creates a slightly more expensive option. I think deferring IFRS 9 solves the mismatch and also solves for both of these cost elements that we're talking about. For me, I therefore think that there is some merit to deferral, but I think it's merit in a very constrained circumstance. And I'd be inclined to say what we're weighing up for me in looking at the two different methods is the cost versus benefit. Now, again, I agree with where Pat's coming from in that the key cost of not adopting IFRS 9 is not getting the ECL, expected credit loss model. I think that's the core loss, and we may need to think about how we remedy that. I think, Issa, you spoke about it in terms of costs, in terms of disclosures. Mm-hmm. So that would be one way that we can remedy it. But I think that's the key element. But in the context of a pure insurance company that is applying an IFRS 4 that already requires a lot of adjustments from users of the financial statements, I'm probably more comfortable with accepting that cost. As soon as I stray outside of a pure insurance company, I start becoming more concerned. And so I would not find it acceptable to apply the deferred model to the mixed type of approach. But to Pat's point, there are some real questions we're considering here. I think the first is the ECL model, given that we accept it's an improvement, the cost is that we're not going to have that. Against that is the fact that we were introducing additional costs, and overlay does bring an extra cost on top of that. Sue?
My reasoning's pretty similar to Daryl's, actually. I am not convinced by the cost type arguments that people are raising and the amount of rework they are saying would be required by applying IFRS 9 before the new insurance contract standard, but I do have some sympathy for the mismatch issue, and I feel some level of responsibility given the difference in timing between our two projects. I don't believe that the costs of the overlay are prohibitive for people, so I continue to think that it's still a very valid mechanism to deal with the mismatch issue, particularly because I think that's the issue we should be solving. But having said that, and even though I don't think the costs are prohibitive, I think there are additional costs. And I think if you're an entity that is really just an insurance company, it will be a bit of a pain in the neck to go through and sort of tag all your assets and work out which ones were accounted for in one way under IAS 39 that moved to fair value through P&L under IFRS 9, and there are costs associated with that. So I think for that group of entities, deferral is a cleaner solution for the mismatch problem. Now, I certainly don't feel that great about having done all of this user outreach and then sort of coming up being supportive of a recommendation that's pretty contrary to what the user preferences are. But I think, and I'm going to stray again beyond the first question, the package that's proposed for me is a fair balance between what we're being told by other people and what users are asking for, because one of the key things I took away from the users was a concern about loss of comparability. And so the way that we'd come up with this predominance test and defined a pure insurer, I think, made it a worse problem for the users than it could otherwise be. By staying at the reporting entity level and therefore listening to them on that, and by trying to come up with a better scope for what we consider to be a pure insurer to apply the deferral approach, I think we can cause fewer problems for the user community. So I think we will have listened in that sense. We will have used the overlay in other more mixed businesses, which the users prefer. So I think it is, for me, Pat, a reasonable balance between the different perspectives that we've heard.
Martin?
Your same as Tara and Sue. And regarding the cost argument, I really cannot judge if mandatory for the overlay approach there is some additional cost. If we allow for the temporary exception, if that would really reduce cost because it is only a timing difference, I think there is also argument that maybe there are a group of assets, maybe currently they would have to apply the expected loss model, but maybe in the future they will decide to may have it on a fair value measurement basis, so that could also be argued that this cost could be avoided. Maybe some is classification of all this discussion of business activity, and I think, if you change the whole liability side for insurance, I think it is easier for them and maybe would reduce cost if you can do it in one rush also the asset side instead to have a staggered approach. But you can debate that, but at least we have heard from many of the insurance companies that are additional costs, and this argument and the volatility, the accounting mismatch argument, that is why I think, it is a solution which we could offer because it is limited in time. It is not forever, it is only for a certain period. And I think for these companies, it would be easier to adopt IFRS 9 and IFRS 4 new at the same time.
Amaru?
Thanks, Hans. But it was a very interesting debate that helped me in deciding which side I would go. I started out with very sympathetic view to the South American position, that is doing nothing, because of the arguments that IFRS 9 is quite supportive. And I think anything that we do will bring tension in terms of applying IFRS 9 in some regions, particularly in that region. And so I understand the position. I do share their view. And then when it comes to this, I think the natural position for myself would be doing nothing, because of course I do prefer IFRS 9 alternative. However, this would, in terms of alternatives, I would be sympathetic to the overlay, because of to provide, to take care of the mismatch and to also provide the comparability. But then when I go to the overlay, I think, well, but I'm imposing the costs. So if I'm not open to do anything, but as a compromise, this is the very position of the majority of users, I'm open to the overlay, that's not really fair, because then I would say, okay, go to the overlay and have the cost of having the same, the both systems all the time. Then I think, despite all the arguments, I think if I did permit myself to entertain to an alternative, I have to agree with the temporary exemption, because this is the only way, and optional. I think option is important in my view because of my original position. So they have the alternative. And I think two aspects will be key, the eligibility criteria, in terms of capturing what is really insurance portion of the group, I would say, and the fixed date in this sense, aligning with Martin's argument. That's a date established to end. So it was, as Dario mentioned, it was very fine line for me to decide. But I think instead of going to the overlay, if I accept the overlay as a compromise, I do have personally to accept the temporary exemption, because of costs.
Well, what I have learned in my experience, when you do big reforms, first of all, it's the end goal that counts. And you have to be flexible in the transition period towards reaching that end goal to help people getting there. And I think, well, first of all, this is a huge reform. It's probably the most important standard that we, most important, biggest improvement that we make in accounting in these years. I mean, IFRS 9, of course, a big improvement, but not such a huge improvement over IAS 39 as this is over the existing IFRS 4. We have involuntarily, but we have created a situation which everybody realizes is not ideal, which is that the two standards, IFRS 9 and IFRS 4, will have a difference in date of effectiveness, which causes problems. Well, we can debate on is the deferral enough to solve the problems or not. It is clear to me that the overlay takes care of most of the problems, but that deferral goes a little bit further, and that people are not entirely pointless in pleading for it. So that is the reason why I am inclined to support this without going below the entity level, I might say, because then you're really creating a mess. We have momentum now behind IFRS 4. There is a growing realization in the sector it's going to be done. And there is a lot of goodwill there, and I don't want to impair that goodwill. And that is I don't want to endanger that goodwill, because by being highly principled about what is at most a transition problem. You can be totally cynical, of course, and say, well, the transition period is going to be endless, and we'll have these two standards next to each other in the insurance industry forever. I cannot believe that. The world is in urgent need of this standard. I am absolutely convinced we're going to get it done, and the transition period will be over, and these transition measures will be over at a certain point. And that's why I am inclined to support this. Okay. Shall we have a vote?
If you wish.
Yeah.
That we're going to do it on the package.
You could do it all at the end.
All at the end? Yeah. Okay.
We still have another poll question.
We could have voted. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Let's do them all together.
Yes. Okay. So that's the second interrelated question, is if you do offer the temporary exemption or the deferral, at what level do you offer that? The paper clearly sets out the below the reporting entity level arguments, as well as the arguments to stay at the reporting entity level, which is what was exposed in the ED. Staff are recommending staying at the reporting entity level because we think it's more useful to present consistent accounting policies in the group financial statements. And this part of the topic did attract a lot of attention in the comment letter.
Yeah. Sue.
On the topic of users, I thought one very interesting argument that came up as part of the discussion on deferral, even though a lot of them didn't like it, when they talked about at or below the reporting entity level, one of the comments that they made that was interesting was they could sort of see a world where you had what you had today. So you had IAS 39 applying everywhere, and they could see a future where IFRS 9 applied everywhere, but they couldn't really see the benefit in having an interim world where they had to go from IAS 39 to a mix of 39 and 9, and then ultimately to 9. And for me, that was one of the very compelling reasons for convincing me, reconfirming my preference, that we stay at the reporting entity level. And I think it also works best in conjunction with the overlay. Because if you've got more mixed groups, then you can use the overlay. If you've got a more pure group, reporting entity level, and the cleanliness of that is better.
Wait, what?
No, firstly, I just want to highlight, I will support all the proposal by the staff. But one clarification, related to the discussion we had about the segmental report. We discussed, if assess from reporting entity level. Let's assume you have 80 bank, 20 insurance, mm-hmm. they're not qualified mm-hmm. for deferral. Then we say, for segmental reporting, you can still report insurance sector based on 39. Mm-hmm. Let's turn around. If the entity is 20% bank, 80% insurance, it will be qualified for deferral. So, as a reporting entity, they will use 39. Mm-hmm. So when for segmental reporting, the banking sector.
Yes, they can apply IFRS 9 if they wish to, in the segmental reporting.
Then, if that is the case, I think we should emphasize, make it clear.
Sure.
I think this is, in my view, most of the sensitive point why people say yes or not is because they still want to have some comparative information across the banks or across insurance. If we make this argument at this point clearer, then I think users will feel a little bit comfort, and the regulator will also feel a little bit comfort.
Darryl.
So said earlier, the reason why I was comfortable to live with deferral was because of the fact that there were more costs involved in the overlay approach, and that I accepted that to Sue's term, we need to accept some responsibility for that happening. I was also prepared to go down that route, even though I took the view from his presentation that was not entirely what users would have absolutely preferred us to do. I was prepared to do it because for me there were two extenuating circumstances, are two things that if you like softened the blow of it. The first is that the approach of saying that you stick with IAS 39 meant that it was a simple approach that kept things exactly the same way through the whole. The The second was that there would be no change to existing accounting for a period of time, and that that period of time would be 2021, or before when that change in existing accounting happened. To my mind, as soon as we start saying that we go below the reporting level, both of those extenuating circumstances, if you like, break down. The first is users now have to deal with a lot more complexity in that they're dealing with both 39 and IFRS 9 in the same set of financial statements. The second is that they are now going to go through two substantial changes. One from IFRS I39 to some mixture of the two, and then one from the mixture of the two to IFRS 9. And to my mind, those two things sway the balance, because now we're saying for the saving of a limited additional cost, we're going to put a lot of costs and complexity onto users. And I think that's what pushes me to be on. So I would very much agree that we can do the deferral, but I think it would be subject to us not having this mixed model.
Gary? I support doing this at the end, at the reporting entry level and no lower. I think it makes it vastly more complicated if you want to go a level down. I mean, whether it's there's a concern about transferring assets or liabilities back and forth, and of course you've got the corporate allocations. What is a segment liability? You know, is the capitalized? You know, I'm sorry. Does the debt is part of your company capital? Does that get pushed down? You know, I think it solves an awful lot of issues. And then, well, if you push it down, is it the segment level reporting? Is it the legal entity level, a line of business level, and so on? I think it's. Lastly, I think it's a lot easier to audit. You know, if you just do it at the group level, and eliminate all these other difficulties and challenges. So I really don't see it being particularly easy or even plausible to do other than at the consolidated level.
Ian.
Yes, I'm not in favor of a temporary deferral for the reasons set out in our alternative view, and not much has changed from there from what I've heard. I don't know that I can fully accept Darrell's argument that overlay is terribly expensive. It'll be difficult. I'm not sure that's right. The best argument I heard, and I have to butter up to the chairman, was, you know, this is temporary, it's small, we've got goodwill running, let's get on and finish the insurance project. But I just wonder how much of that goodwill we will retain if we don't go below the reporting level. I'm not in favour of going below the reporting level, but I just make the comment that I think a lot of our constituents will be very unhappy with a temporary exemption that doesn't go below the reporting level. So I'm in a funny position. I don't believe in a temporary exemption, and if we do have it, I don't think we should go below the reporting level, but if we don't, we've blown one of Hans's best reasons for having the temporary exemption, I think.
Well, if we wouldn't do that first, then we certainly would have no goodwill left in the sector. And I think there will be still, I mean,
yeah.
But the ultimate solution that we will have, I'm sure, that will help most of the insurance companies. Jiang Wu.
Thank you. I generally agree with Dr. Stapp's recommendation. We should stick to the at the reporting entity level. However, let me ask Martin. When we discussed about the segment reporting and below the reporting entity level, you said there are many specialists in this kind of insurance companies just to like compare the insurance to insurance rather than insurance and the combination of insurance to bank. So what I would like to, you know, here is still the group's consolidated financial statements is very important, right, to the investors generally, including the specialists too, right?
I think so, because man, that is what we, I think, discussing about, because it's also Vegas point, man. I think these companies are free to do in their segment reporting whatever they think is best, so run their internal management accounting on. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think what we are discussing here is really the consolidated accounts. And that is, I think, I'm still convinced that also for this kind of mixed groups, they have some meaning, because otherwise, I think we should have come up with different conclusions of consolidated accounts. Therefore, I think it is, and based on my experience, man, What we're discussing here is some bank insurers which want to have it below the reporting entity level. But based on my recollection when I worked in a bank, most of these banks which now claiming, okay, they should have done it, they are compared with pure banks. And that is, I think, what we heard from and what I agree to users is, okay, that is really important that we have comparability. And then to go even further level down, then we have another group of mixed entity, which is IAS 39, IFRS 9. This is a total mess. So I think what Hans is doing here, compromise, but no going even further, I think, is too much, is then too much.
But still, generally, there are, you know, heterogeneous business. Some groups have a very different business of line of business. But still, the cat consolidated financial is still very useful to compare this kind of a big global groups.
But as I said, man, in Germany we have, look at Daimler, Mercedes, yeah. They have a big banking business, they have a big insurance business, they have car making business. But does it mean that the consolidated accounts does not have any meaning? I don't think so. My people trade them with earning multipliers, which are based on the consolidated. My clearly there is additional information, that's the reason why we have segment information. But it does not mean that segment information is enough. I think consolidated information is on top of that and has also kind of meaning, and therefore I think we have to stick with one policies in this consolidated accounts.
Well, to that argument, maybe I could put a marker on it, because when I look at the balance sheet and the financial statements of Daimler, there is a column consolidated, and next to it there are two columns, one for the industrial activities and one for the banking. So there are three columns in their balance sheet, which tell me that the consolidated accounts mean something, but maybe the users want to go more at the below the reporting entity level and look at the performance of the Daimler industrial activities and the Daimler financial activities separately to make an assessment. But otherwise, they would not have columns on the face of the financial statements. Same with Renault and Peugeot. Now, the reason, Patrick, why, if you wanted to have each board member justify his position,
please,
is on balance, weighing the arguments of those preparers who are mostly concerned, i.e. the ones who are not already at full fair value or current value on their financial statements, against the position of the users which have mixed views, especially coming from the same continents where those preparers are affected. And taking on top of that the position of all regulators, six of them which answer the even seven now with IOSCO, the last one, which are pretty unified in this respect. They support our proposals. That's the reason why. There is no clear-cut position from the users, especially
there
when
is.
Looking...
There is. From the users, there is.
Well, it depends which continent on which...
What continent you are we?
Well, I mean,
yeah. It's like Europe.
Yeah. Well, there are issues. There are mixed views. Some support our proposal, some don't. And the preparers, the ones who are mostly affected, support our proposals. The ones who are not affected, as Martin said, is no point, not relevant. In fact, on top of that, all the regulators, whether they are market regulators, prudential regulators, banking regulators, they all support our proposals. That's the basis on which I'm leaning towards the staff proposal. Now, I have a question to follow up on the expected credit loss on the segment information. Let's take an insurance group which has a banking activity, not a bank insurer, but an insured banker, right? Which the banking activities is 20% of the total activities, and the insurance is 80%. This banking activity, let's assume it's a legal entity or segment, it will have to report under IFRS 9 at the same time as all other banks, because banking regulators will ask this entity to report under IFRS 9. Never mind what is done at consolidated level. This banking activity may have some borrowings on the market, so it may be subject to IFRS directly. It may have some minority shareholders. So for many reasons, it will have to report separately under IFRS 9 as soon as IFRS 9 is effective. They will have the expected credit losses information in their financial statement from that date. And if the parent company which consolidates qualifies for the deferral, they will undo all this good information in consolidation. Is there a way that we could kind of keep this valid information prepared at the banking level and disclose it together with the consolidated accounts? That's the point I'd like us to think about, because it will be available from 1/1/18.
I think we hear that that need for additional disclosures for the temporary exemption, and that's definitely one suggestion that we will consider seriously when we come back to you on what the disclosure should be for the temporary exemption.
By the way, would such a bank or bank insurer bank, wouldn't they almost automatically choose for the overlay approach?
Yeah, they may choose for the overlay, but reverse overlay, it's kind of a reverse overlay. They would undo the IFRS 9 information and go back to IFRS 39 for consolidation, which is just the opposite of overlay, so reverse overlay. Yes.
Mary.
I feel I'm somewhat similar position to Ian. I think I'd characterize it as in respect to the question of the deferral approach generally. I'm not yet convinced it's a good idea, but I was somewhat disappointed that our brilliant alternative view did not attract a hallelujah chorus. And it didn't. And, you know, seriously, if you go back to the summary of user feedback, there, you know, many of the users did reject the deferral idea, and I certainly heard some myself who were quite vocal and fluent about it, but there were some, and it notes in paper 14B that it was those who focused primarily on insurance and are not as worried about cross-sector, and presumably we're also thinking about the types, you know, presumption on my part, the types of assets and not expressing as significant a concern about the expected credit loss that they thought it was too big a price to pay. But I am convinced that going below the reporting entity is a bad idea based on the feedback that we have had so far. And so, you know, the feedback that we've had has at least allowed me to make a differentiation that I didn't make going into the ED about costs and benefits of different approaches. I think a number of people have spoken about the concerns about below the reporting entity, and I think that just that was when we had discussions with users, even though the ones who said, I believe you should not do deferral, but then went on to say, but if you do, there's just no circumstance under which you should do below the reporting entity. So I think even they were talking in those terms.
Okay, let's go to the next question.
So the next question is an interrelated question again on the temporary exemption, which you already, some board members have already picked up on. And it is the consideration of whether there should be a fixed expiry date on the temporary exemption. Staff recommends that there should be a fixed expiry date because the temporary exemption can only be predicated on it being there for a short period of time. We will bring at a future meeting what that fixed expiry date is. So that's question three.
Don't think we need a lengthy discussion on this.
Yeah.
Yes, I need to respond to the question.
No.
No.
Are you going to talk about the expiration date?
I'm going to talk about this. The reason why.
With an introduction of one half an hour? okay, no, yeah, go ahead.
Well, the reason why I decided to live with temporary exemption is because we have this expiry date. And but by having expiry date, we can make it a short period of time. And if it is a short period of time, then we could live with it, you know, at the messy situation. So that is why I decided to live with temporary exemption. But on top of that, I would like to encourage preparers to make early application rather than wait for expiry date. So if they make an early application, then they can shorten this period of confusion, and we have to provide the good tools to promote the and encourage the early application of IFRS 4.
So question four then is on the overlay approach itself, and here again staff is recommending confirming the ED proposals to proceed with an overlay approach, because that approach, as many board members have already noted, could be usefully used in a financial conglomerate sense, and also some entities have indicated that they intend to apply that approach. So any further comments beyond what was already raised on the overlay approach?
Given all the praise for the overlay approach, I don't think that...
Tak?
Yep. I would like to reserve my decision on this overlay approach because my first preference was overlay approach without deferral approach because it's simple. However, now we will live with temporary exemption as well. So eventually, it's going to be a mixture of temporary exemption and the overlay approach. And then it makes the situation very chaotic. So that is what I would like to avoid. And the other thing I was wondering is later date, we are going to discuss the scope of the temporary exemption. So eventually, we may expand the scope of the temporary exemption, and there would be lots of tension between the, those who are eligible for temporary exemption and those who are not. But we are going to provide other methods like overlay approach. That sounds good, but I don't think it's a good way, because it only makes things so intransparent. So therefore, when we discuss the scope of the exemption, anyway, preparer has to make a judgment. We cannot make it a rule basis. So therefore, it totally depends on the judgment of the preparers, insurers. Then, in that case, I don't think we have to provide the other method. So therefore, we have to make it simpler. This is just a matter of effective date. Simply accept delay of effective date. That's all. Make the life simpler. That's
better. Assume the overlay approach better than pure 39. It is also optional.
Yes.
Will you be against?
Yes. That is why I'm quite against the overlay approach, because we are going to discuss what kind of asset you can designate in the later date, but it's going to be very subjective, and we are not going to make a narrow scope to those who can accept overlay, who can adopt overlay approach. Even if you have a small amount of insurance contract, you can apply overlay approach. So if that is the case, they can make kind of choice of asset, which you can designate for the overlay approach, and that is. Kind of earnings management, and that is what I don't like, because it's optional, and it's optional to the issue insurers to choose what kind of asset to make a presentation of overlay.
Okay.
And the final question, the final question is the optional versus mandatory, but this applies to both the temporary exemption and the overlay approach. And again, here we had quite divergent views again from the users on the optionality versus the rest of the constituents. However, staff recommends confirming that both approaches are optional because staff thinks it's inappropriate to prohibit an entity from applying IFRS 9 when IFRS 9 is a significant improvement to IS 39. So that is, for that question, quite a few board members have already expressed an opinion. Is there anybody else who wishes to discuss the optionality? But so bearing that in mind, can I ask you to turn to 23 for the all questions, and that we'll vote in the series. So question one, do board members agree to the ED proposal to provide a temporary exemption?
Three, 11 in favor.
11 in favor. Does the board agree to confirm the ED proposal that the eligibility for the temporary exemption should be determined at the reporting entity level only?
With the specifics to be discussed later.
Yes.
13 in favour.
That's again.
13.
Okay. Does the board agree to confirm that there should be a fixed expiry date for the temporary exemption? We'll bring back to you what that fixed expiry date should be.
13 in favour.
Yeah. Does the board agree to confirm the ED proposal to provide an overlay approach?
So 13 again.
13 again.
No. Here, no.
No, it's going to be lucky numbers. Okay.
Different 13.
Yeah. High quality notes.
And the last question on the optionality. Does the board agree to confirm the ED proposal that the temporary exemption from applying IFRS 9 and the overlay approach should be optional?
All in favour.
Okay, so thank you very much. The next one should be very quick. It just outlines the project plan, which is on page 24-25. It just outlines the issues that we intend to bring back based on the comment letter summary. Do you have any questions and comments?
No, except that we commend you for working so fast and doing the outreach very quickly and writing good papers that allowed us to make hopefully good decisions.
Okay.
All right. Then we're going to define business. Now for the really important stuff.
Thirteen.